They can do anything they want to us. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian.
Fred Hampton got it right. And we're getting it wrong. The youth of today aren't calling themselves revolutionary. The workers aren't fighting for their class interests. Sure, at the universities, they might be talking about things like racism, imperialism, and class inequality, but their liberal postmodernist mindset lacks a radical understanding of the causes of these problems. Is there a way to reverse this trend? There is. Red Star U. A totally new method of agitation. It's simple and it works. The most radical thinkers presenting their view. Dank memes and propaganda on our side for a change. We destroy bourgeois myths like American exceptionalism, the possibility of economic equality under capitalism. Because we have faith that reason and the science of socialism are fully compatible. These are things students almost never learn. But when they do, they will have the theoretical tools they need to question and probe their bourgeois liberal ideology. Liberated from capitalist hegemony, there's no telling how revolutionary they'll get. Reason beats superstition and materialism beats idealism every time. Just give us a few minutes of your time and we'll do the rest. Thousands are already watching. Red Star U explains why socialism is the only revolutionary force that can make the world a better place, 5 minutes at a time. To win the revolution, all we need is you, Red Star U. Subscribe now.
Welcome, welcome. This is the Three Left Show. I am your host, Dan Platt, here again for another week. A little sick and without my co-host, Michael. He had an assignment that he needed to work on. This is the left-wing, radical-slash-revolutionary podcast-slash-radio program, Reading Hour for the Curious or the Committed, covering post-capitalist issues of organizing, how to build a better world in the shell, the old, insert your left-leaning motto here. What am I going to cover this week? I have quite a lot. So it's basically, I've got extension of last week's episode where I and Michael discussed communism of the past, particularly the 30s, the interwar years, you know, rising fascism, lack of, you know, so some militant organizing, but not particularly a lot of it. But even then, there was still more than there is now. So how much more nervous should we be? But first, something fresh and something fun first. A update on a story I covered about a month where I covered the Satanic Temple, an atheist organization that basically wields lawsuits and performance as well as, you know, to use the laws of quote-unquote religious freedom, a.k.a. American theocracy, to where, you know, the laws where the hyper-religious or the evangelical use legislation and politicians and their money power, the money buys influence, to assert their values and dogmas on the rest of us. Some atheists fight back by countersuing, and thus they've created an organization that is under federal rules religious. Thus, they have standing in these various cases where it's like, no, we're an actual religion too, and we are going to assert secular values through this religious jurisprudence. So how they have done this now, and their main sector of activity this year is abortion rights, to exert that there is a, you know, there's a religious right to an abortion by creating their religion, the Satanic Temple. I covered their kind of their press release originally, their announcement of the campaign, where they will be, you know, creating the legal fight. And created a satanic ritual around it that is pretty secular as far as what it invokes. You know, you're not actually like, I bless this abortion in the name of Satan. No, it's actually very atheistic, and that's the point. And likewise, here from the blog The Friendly Atheist, which I've kind of been connected to ever since I was a new atheist back in my college years, headline is Satanists Sue Lamar Advertising for Rejecting Their Pro-Abortion Billboards. So Lamar, boo, big monopolistic corporation that controls most of the billboards in America. They're very exploitative. Their pricing is outrageous. This idea that like, oh, just buy a billboard, advertise your cause. It's thousands of dollars, dog. It's a lot of money. And it's mostly because you have one company like Lamar, or a few, controlling all those billboards. So all those billboards you see, that visual pollution, as I would call it. I prefer we just ban billboards, but as long as they're around, let's try to use them. Eventually, we'll paint flower murals on all of them, or Black Lives Matter, or Black Power stuff. I love that too. So this is by the Friendly Atheist is Hemant Mehta. He's been active since 2006, at least. I don't know exactly when, but he covers the goings on of the atheist movement or whatever is left of it. At the moment, the Satanic Temple is what's left of it, as far as I'm concerned, as far as people actually making a positive impact. From my point of view. Last month, the Satanic Temple announced a new campaign meant to fight back against abortion restrictions throughout the country. So doing more than what the Democratic Party will ever actually say they're doing. Especially as the ground collapses under the precedent of Roe v. Wade. So it's also kind of a worst case scenario. Well, you know, instead of just hammering about the Supreme Court and we got to vote for Biden because of the Supreme Court, we got to protect Roe v. Wade. Okay, first of all, rights are not protected by these quote-unquote judges. They're protected with action and by, you know, taking responsibility for protecting our rights on ourselves. That means fighting the anti-abortion people, if you are pro-abortion, as I am. The Satanists said that all first trimester abortions must be, so this is just the first trimester, still early, exempt from state regulations that hinder access to the procedure because such hurdles violated two of their seven fundamental tenets regarding bodily autonomy and adherence to best scientific practice. So they have their own quote-unquote commandments. They call them the fundamental tenets. The idea here is simple. If a Satanist lives in a state where she cannot obtain a legal abortion, she can file a lawsuit and claim she has a religious right to one by using an argument conservative Christians have used all too successfully. It might be possible to override statewide abortion bans. Whether that strategy works remains to be seen. Well, they're going to try anyway. But the folks at the Satanic Temple are nothing if not effective marketers. And last month, they tried to put up eight billboards near crisis pregnancy centers in Arkansas and Indiana. Those centers are the deceptive places often run by Christians, or evangelical Christians to be exact, who try to steer clients away from abortions. So these billboards would have been a way to let women know that Satanism could help them circumvent state restrictions and get the abortion they desire. Before that could happen, though, Satanists had to submit designs to Lamar Advertising for approval. They ended up submitting four of them. Okay, so I only saw the first one where on the left is a bowl of cake batter and with the text, not a cake, and a egg with a sperm going into it with the text, not a baby. And then in the middle text, our religious abortion ritual averts many state restrictions with their website, thesatanictemple.com, and their logo, which does in fact have a Baphomet head in a pentagram star. See, another two have two women talking. Their text says, Susan, you're telling me I do not have to endure the waiting period when I have an abortion? That's true if you're a Satanist. Same text as on the right. And then the other is a kind of Phyllis Schlafly looking woman holding up a sick hailing Hitler. Kind of weird, kind of surrealist, I guess. A little Dada there. And it says, what if abortion had been an option? Oh, Jesus. Okay, that's problematic. I don't like that one. And the other one is abortion save lives. Big, bold text. Pregnancy complications are the sixth most common cause of death among women between the ages of 20 and 34. Thus, the reason legal abortion is an actual net positive for women and women's health. They need to be accessible. Because otherwise, back alley abortions, it's bad. Bad, folks. In any case, Lamar Advertising rejected all four designs without explanation. Even when pressed, they wouldn't say what they found objectionable. They just tore up the contract worth a little more than 16 grand, for a month's worth of those billboards. Now the Satanic Temple has filed a lawsuit, which is, you know, see, like, they have to file a lawsuit just to advertise, which would further the ability of others to kind of create a class action lawsuit, which would be, you know, stronger, against the company, saying this was a breach of their contract, that Lamar Advertising has accepted designs that are arguably more controversial, and that the company is guilty of religious discrimination, mostly referring to billboards where you have, like, a bloodied fetus, you know, bloody fetus in a jar, and, you know, it says, save the children. TST, the Satanic Temple, actually replied in good faith on Lamar's promise by creating the billboard designs, making every reasonable effort to cure Lamar's objections and offering Lamar money. Notwithstanding its promise, Lamar now refuses to place any form of billboard. While a goes-too-far case could be made against a couple of those designs, the very last one is just words. It's straightforward. There's no reason to say no to that. Ultimately, the Satanists want women to know that they don't need to be guilt-tripped out of an abortion. The choice is still theirs. And if Republicans get their way and the federal law protecting that right disappears, women should still be able to point to their religion to protect their bodily autonomy. So this is kind of like the last line that we've created, since we couldn't use secular law to protect our, you know, we can't invoke general health concerns. It's all culture war issue, right? It's all something that's quote-unquote political. So for the rest of the show, so that was the fun update there, quote-unquote fun story. The rest will be more of the general, like, back to what I've been doing the last month or two. It's an ongoing conversation. That's the kind of format I like, where I build on concepts mentioned in one episode and try to clarify or expand on them in another. And lately, so of course, you know, until the election actually passes, I'm going to be talking Green Party strategy or voting strategy, electoralism, general, how to operate politically in our system that is utterly corrupt. It's not broken. It works quite well for the ruling class. That is what it means to be a radical, to know that it's not broken. It can't be reformed. This is how it works. This is how it's supposed to work. We need drastic change. Now the question then is, how do we get it, or what kind of changes, what is the best way of going about that? Let's look to history. That's what we're going to be doing the rest of the episode. First, we're going to be covering a Jacobin piece. So first, let's hit on what Jacobin... This is from May. This is when they were kind of first staking out their position post-Bernie ending his campaign. This is from a Louis Prozek, the unrepentant Marxist. I've read him before. Been a while, though. And this was from May, like I said, right after Bernie dropped out. On April 28th, a 71-year-old professor named Peter Dreyer lit into Bashar Shakura in The Nation magazine with the kind of ferocity that made you wonder if the Jacobin editor had co-produced Planet of the Humans, titled WTF is Jacobin's editor thinking in voting green? Dreyer reacted to the April 22nd tweet that was probably not intended to create any kind of controversy. The tweet read, this is from the editor of Jacobin, by the way, or founder, I'm going to vote for Howie Hawkins, but I'm not a believer in building the Green Party. This incenses me, by the way. No matter what your individual choice is in November, the political act is to organize on issues like Medicaid for All, build orgs, and back down ballot candidates supporting the Bernie agenda. I find this odd. You know, he's a socialist. He's about promoting socialist causes. Why doesn't he say socialist agenda? Say what you mean. You know, Bernie agenda. Bernie's old news now. He ended his campaign. But he's talking to the Bernie crowd, or the crowd that was following Bernie, and maybe they weren't on board for socialism. But, I mean, they must have been tolerant of it. They're like, you know, of that type when asked in polls, like, do you prefer capitalism or socialism? And they say socialism, despite meaning to them maybe just government welfare programs. You can even describe the tweet as damning with faint praise, since it disavows support for the Greens as a party and uses most of its 280 characters reminding his readers to vote Democrat, right? Because that's when down ballot Bernie agenda people refer to. Like many other liberals, Dreyer repeats the same arguments that have been heard ad infinitum ever since Ralph Nader was blamed for allowing George Bush to be elected in 2000. Rather than holding Al Gore up to the scrutiny he deserved as Bill Clinton's neoliberal sidekick, people like The Nation's Eric Alderman and the singularity loathsome Todd Gitem blame Nader for being a spoiler. I had never run across Dreyer before, but a brief search reveals that he was the subject of a 2014 LA Review Books article by Tom Gallagher titled, "Those Still Going On About Ralph Nader Electing Bush in 2000 Should Desist." And so let's skip ahead. Because why is he talking about Dreyer here, this liberal professor? Dreyer tries hard to make a vote for Biden sound palatable. Thanks in part to Sanders and the Democratic Party's leftward shift, Biden has adopted other progressive stances on key issues. Minimum wage, health care, workers' rights, abortion, climate change, and college debt. And could be pushed further left during the campaign and after he takes office. There's a big push going on in the South of Biden campaign to people in their 20s and 30s who can't stand him, including the women who are disgusted by the arguments of Linda Hirschman in the New York Times op-ed, "I believe Tara Reid, I'm voting for Joe Biden anyway." So, that's all wrong, isn't it? Hasn't that been borne out as being complete wish fulfillment? You know, it's projecting your desires. Oh yes, Biden has adopted all of these progressive stances. I'm not for the Green New Deal. Abortion? No, we're not funding that. Hatch Act. Always running away. Just 2 years after Sakara launched Jacobin, he was working audaciously to burnish his left credentials. This meant downplaying the Sandinista politics of the recent past, getting ISOers and other Marxist critics of the Democratic Party to write for Jacobin, and generally striking leftist poses. He threw the gauntlet down, this writer is calling the editor of Jacobin a virtue signaler, but a leftist one. He threw the gauntlet down against the liberal establishment in the pages of The Nation in an open letter that he had subheaded "Liberalism," including much of what's published in this magazine, seems well-intentioned but inadequate. The solution lies in the reemergence of American radicalism. Bravo. I do agree with that. In introducing himself to Nation readers, Sakura supplied a bit of autobiographical information. It goes into him as a person. We don't really need that. Not really into focusing on the individual people here, because to me, Sakura represents something a bit larger, a kind of Dem entryism, but not quite, but arguing like as if they're not. And this will come in later. Yes, you know, it makes clear the position that, like, we run as third party and we'll lose. But Dreyer is not assuaged by what Sakara and Grisella tell DSAers and Jacobin readers in these kind of circulations. He wants the full Monty, with them on the stage fully naked, playing trumpets and banging the drums for Biden. Missing entirely from both Dreyer's attack and Sakara's defense is any recognition of the gravity of the situation we now face. Economists, especially those writing from the Hoover Institute or the Heritage Foundation, these are establishment think tanks, are predicting a plunge into a Great Depression-type misery with hunger, homelessness, and lack of health care. It's already beginning. Meanwhile, Lori Garrett argues that a 3-year pandemic is the best-case scenario. Keep that in mind, people who think, next year will be somewhat better. We'll be over this by now. Yeah, of course not. Numbers are still rising in various states. Facing such a disaster, what hopes can we place in either a Biden presidency or a Chicago party surrogate model that is based on incremental change through the election of candidates like AOC, who was the only Democrat to vote against Trump's pro-billionaire bailout? There are 236 Democrats in the House of Reps, and only one votes the right way? Is the idea to organize DSA to back candidates who think and act like AOC? To tell you the truth, I'd expect her to become much more like Nancy Pelosi than the other way around. Right now, there are wildcat strikes taking place all around the country. Imagine the impact it would have if DSA began organizing people to get jobs in meatpacking houses, Amazon fulfillment centers, and other frontline essential companies. In the 1930s, the Communist Party sent people into coal mines, steel mills, and auto plants. The Trotskyists sent Farrell Dobbs into a warehouse doing the same kind of dirty work that Howie Hawkins did before he retired as a Teamster last year, which shows where Harry Hawkins kind of comes from in his politics. That to organize workers, you need to actually take a working class job. For the DSA to become part of the burgeoning movement, it will have to wake up to the reality we face today and drop the neo-Edward Bernstein incrementalism. Now, Edward Bernstein is the founder of the DSA. The idea of slow and steady change leading to a social democratic government in the U.S. 20 or so years from now is very much utopian. It is far more likely that we are headed into unimaginable disasters with maybe 1 million-plus victims of the capitalist back-to-work drive. Young radicals to the left of the DSA have to figure out a way to consolidate their ranks and begin the process of building such a revolutionary movement. Howie Hawkins and his running mate, Angela Walker, are clearly too old to play this role, but they can play a major role in drawing clear class lines that are so necessary today as we enter a period in which catastrophe is the norm. Dara worries that Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker will be spoilers once again. In reality, the true spoilers will be the Democratic Party machinery in New York that has already made ballot access for third parties onerous. They have tripled the necessary votes we need to retain our ballot line. Given the absolutely horrendous Hobson's choice, I don't know what that refers to, between Trump and Biden, but I guess a Hobson's choice is like a Sophie's choice. Well, in that case, a Sophie's choice would be which one, like you want both. But a Hobson's choice is you want neither, but you have to pick one. I guess it was like a mirror of Sophie's choice. More people than ever will be open to voting for the Green Party. Unlike Sakara, Hawkins understands that it will take a revolutionary movement. I've covered that point before. Next, I will hit a independent story, which builds on this and, you know, general topic here. It's titled, People Worry That Moderate Democrats Like Joe Biden Are the Same as Republicans. Our study suggests they may be right. So a little bit of, I told you so slash, you know, I'm justified in my beliefs. What justify your beliefs, sir or madam? Headline, subheadline. Men who refer to themselves as moderate or centrist score basically the same on values and opinions as people who identify themselves as conservative. Filed by Kevin Singer, Melissa Rockenbach. Published the beginning of September. And it's got an frustrated Joe Biden pictured. During an appearance on The View in June, former Second Lady Dr. Jill Biden argued that as a moderate, her husband could sway voters who would have otherwise voted for Donald Trump. When I was out there on the trail, a lot of people came up to me and said, Jill, I'm a Republican, but I'm going to vote for your husband because he's a moderate. She's not the only one valorizing the moderate nature of the former vice president. In the August 13th column in the New York Times, David Brooks, friend of the show, argued that the moderate forces that brought Joe Biden the nomination are far more powerful than the few extremists in Portland and even the leftist illiberals on campus. To pause for a moment there to kind of massage my temples. Now, of course, what makes them more powerful is that they're rich, that they are the 1%. As if, you know, money is what makes, you know, might makes right and wealth, finish the rhyme. If you look at who actually leads change over the course of American history, it's not the radicals. At a certain point, radicals give way to the more prudent and moderate wings of their coalitions. Yes, those are called the nadirs, the downturns. Those are the times where things stagnate. They do happen in a historical cycle, you know, so to speak. But those are not the times that are, they're only celebrated by those that are comfortable, privileged, as you were. And nothing typifies privilege like David Brooks, who was always at war with himself. Others aren't so sure that political moderism or moderation is a virtue. When it comes to addressing climate change, Eric Levitz of New York Magazine argued that a, quote, major obstacle is the tendency of moderate Democrats to mistake their own myopic complacency, you know, the whole like, you know, well, things are going to get better no matter what, for heroic prudence. Political researcher David Adler found that across Europe and North America, centrists are the least supportive of democracy, the least committed to its institutions, and the most supportive of authoritarianism. Furthermore, Adler found that centrists are the least supportive of free and fair elections, as well as civil rights. In the United States, only 25% of centrists agree that civil rights are the essential feature of democracy. Only a quarter of them. Now, of course, what did the rest say? They would probably say property rights, the ability to generate profit and inequality is what makes life worth living. This founding dovetails with observations made by MLK, in his letter from a Birmingham jail. If you haven't heard this quote yet before, you will probably could have. I have almost reached a regrettable conclusion that the great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice. and thus, you know, any evocation of order over the chaos of riots and protesting is, well, you're siding with white supremacy there. And that's kind of where the whole, like, yeah, you're not saying the N-word and you don't consider yourself racist, but you support racism because when you say, oh, but I don't want to be a victim of crime, the criminals. Well, who are the criminals? Who does the police state need to stomp? It's the oppressed. Even if I have to answer that. Even Arthur Brooks, a self-avowed moderate, admits, and this is, I'm still quoting MLK here, admits to the failure of the mainstream moderate progressive formula for how to create a more equal pluralist America, adding, I'm a moderate guy, but the evidence doesn't support moderation when it comes to racial or equity. That's all well and good, but what does the data show? You know, these leaders, these heroes who say that moderates are a problem or they're not a help. They're not part of positive of progress of any kind. So now let's get into their study here. We represent an unprecedented national study of college student beliefs and attitudes at over 120 schools across the nation. This is called the IDEALS study. The study, led by Dr. Matthew Mayhew at Ohio State and Dr. Alyssa Rockenbach, North Carolina State, in partnership with Interfaith Youth Corps, surveyed thousands of students across their 4 years in college, including at the beginning of their first year and the end of their fourth year. In addition to asking students to identify their political orientation, IDEALS also asked them about their commitment to fostering justice, solving global problems, improving others' lives, so just having empathy, and serving with others to address common issues, cooperation, and leading efforts to create positive changes in society. So very vague goals and attributes, but generally they do refer to a value set that is simpatico with left-leaning or progress in a way, not to feed into the, you know, the myth-making of progress and linear growth and whatever. Our findings show that concerns about political moderates, and specifically politically moderate men, are not unfounded. As America battles a global pandemic and an economic collapse, as well as reckoning with systemic racism, IDEALS suggest that moderate men may be the least likely to make a positive difference. Like Biden. When broken down, but again, people are voting for Biden based on what he won't do. When broken down by political leaning, IDEALS found that moderate male students in their senior year were, time to time, the least likely or among the least likely to somewhat or strongly agree with the following statements. I am actively working to foster justice in the world. Half of moderate men. Basically, they were the lowest in all these categories. Well, conservative men were always lower, but they were just above them. I am committed to leading efforts in collaboration with people of other perspectives to create positive change in society. Half. My worldview inspires me to serve with others on issues of common concern. See how, like, general these are? They're so vague and general. Easy to say yes to. But even so, even the liberal men and women are like 85% on a lot of these. So there's 15% that are sitting on their hands, I guess. There's also the survey issue of, like, just breaking everything down between conservative, moderate, and liberal, which, of course, does not take into account actual, like, political spectrums and the diversity of positions one has or worldviews. And thus, like, say, if I was asked this, like, I'm a radical socialist, I would have to say I'm a liberal in the context of the survey. So keep in mind that liberal in these surveys would also include likely anyone who actually does identify as a leftist. Strikingly, in almost every case, the responses of moderate men are very similar to conservative men and women. The level of agreement with the statements above is as much as 14% lower than moderate women, who are more likely than men to lean Democratic, and so on. This liberal's finding is on par with a recent Gallup study encompassing over 29,000 interviews with American adults, which revealed that moderates and conservative remain closely aligned in their ideological preferences. This raises important questions heading into the elections. Is a moderate male candidate a bait and switch for Democratic voters? Are they actually casting their votes for a conservative? I would say a frickin' course. That moderate men most resemble Republicans has been confirmed, of all places, on dating apps. Brittany Wong of HuffPost writes, "It's almost become a coastal cliche at this point. If someone lists their political views as moderate on a dating app, the thinking goes, go ahead and assume the person is a conservative." One interviewee noted, "It's just in my experience, even moderate guys tend to have extremely different views on topics that matter to me, like gun control, women's reproductive rights, and immigration. Sometimes moderate men who appear to bend liberal turn out to be faux woke," according to one interviewee who was initially attracted to someone whose profile featured photos at a women's march. Eventually, he slowly started to drop his facade, revealing behaviors inconsistent with these professed political beliefs. AOC has grown increasingly frustrated with moderate Dems during her tenure, saying in a recent event, "The Democratic Party is not a left one. The Democratic Party is a center or a right-center party." Her chief of staff, Shaket Chakrabarty, recently deleted a tweet comparing two moderate Democratic coalitions, consisting mostly of men, to Southern Democrats who favored segregation and opposed civil rights. Now, of course, they had to delete it, I guess, for PR purposes, but not wrong. During this election cycle, a recurring criticism of Vice President Biden has been his record on school desegregation. And as far as the Democratic Party is concerned, they seem to be A-OK with the fact that schools are more segregated than ever. And it's not because of it's by law, but by the laws of free market economics, that people who can afford a certain place and pay the taxes they can pay, fund the schools that they fund based on property and locality, not by state funds. To be sure, Vice President Biden also aligns with more progressive Democrats on key policy issues, says Paul Waldman, he asserts in the Washington Post, owned by Bezos. Biden is getting more progressive in substance, yet it has done nothing to change his image as a moderate. Oh, I wonder why. Maybe because that's complete bull. Nonetheless, Biden's popularity among Republicans has grown consistently in recent months. A number of prominent former GOP officials and even some Trump ex-staffers have voiced their support for him, including former Governor John Kasich and former Senator Jeff Flake. Their support, however, seems less driven by the good things they believe Biden will do and more by the bad things they believe Biden won't do. In his speech at the DNC, for example, Kasich remarked that Republicans and independents may fear that Biden will turn sharp left and leave them behind, but assured viewers, "I don't believe that." So more and more, because of, you know, following the money, the Democratic Party is becoming the right-wing party, while the quote-unquote right-wing party, the Republicans, are becoming the proto-fascists, the nationalists, the Bonapartists, as the other article will mention them as, which are, you know, like a type of monarchist and central state, you know, powerful central state. If moderate meant, okay, yeah, but then they finish with an interesting kind of, so I see the problem differently, right? I see the problem as all of these people who are not right-wing don't have a major party, right? If all of these people went green and we had maybe like a third of the electorate, it would make more elections a three-way race. But instead, in order to, quote, beat the right-wingers, you have a coalition that's mostly right-wing with the left-winger, with progressives, left-wingers, being subsumed in a party that is dominated and controlled and thus right-wing in character and action. Even when it's doing, you know, progressive urbanist things or cosmopolitan values things, it's still doing them as capitalists would, or they're doing it promoting in what neoliberalism is, which is market competition. We're going to subsidize companies or organizations. We're not just going to redistribute wealth, or we're not going to ensure equity in wealth creation, or we're going to try to, but it's all going to fall on our face since we're still working in a system that goes against that. If moderate, okay, so but instead they see the problem as like moderate men are not engaged civically, that like they're not like the from the survey, it's like, you know, half of them say that they're actually engaged in making the world a better place as they see it. But of course, in my, you know, I don't want them engaged, because their vision of what would make, well, the point of moderation is that you don't have any answers, or the answers you do have are not solutions at all. They're band-aids at best. Okay, but what is clear is that young, moderate men need to be engaged in more opportunities to contribute to sorely needed social change. Gallup estimates, so this is like kind of saying like, we actually don't have democracy, and thus people who don't have views that fit in this duopoly, which is all kinds of confused. If my last 5 minutes ranting made any sense, probably not. That they can't engage effectively. Well, of course, neither can anybody, unless you are, you know, in the managing class. What is clear is that they need to be engaged. Gallup estimates as many as a third of men in America identify as moderate. Won't someone think of the moderate men? Out of all the political groups and ideals, moderate male students contain the highest proportion of non-voters, about a quarter. In 2016, was determined that non-voters had as much to do with election results as those who did vote. Now, they don't vote because they're seeing Biden or the Dems as left-wing and Trump as right-wing, and since they're moderate, they don't have a candidate. So the desire for a more moderate party that's a major player would have a base of support in all of these moderate men and women, whammon, but they also can't organize because they see things individually and like they're waiting for it to be created like a brand of toothpaste. If moderate men are mobilized to take more civic responsibility and contribute more of their energies to working with others for justice and common good, they could be a formidable force for positive change in this unprecedented moment. Perhaps Biden, the empathy candidate, will provide the example and the spark they need, but only time will tell. Very odd way to finish it, but it's basically kind of saying that unlike left-wingers who at least like convince themselves that voting for Biden helps their politics, it doesn't. Moderate men just don't participate. They're non-voters. I remember there's a good example, the antidote, a streamer named Azimagold, and he doesn't plan to vote. And I watched his videos. He's pretty entertaining. He basically mugs for the camera. He's a clown of a type and plays WoW and multiplayer games. And he had this kind of enlightened centrism kind of tack where, like, you know, Antifa are as bad as the Proud Boys. You know, they're both throwing punches, or they're both using the street demonstrations to make their political case or to further their goals, to put it broadly. He doesn't really know anything beyond that, beyond what he sees in viral videos, and thus he's an enlightened centrist, of course. And I use enlightened as a pejorative there, because it's like they, you know, you act enlightened like you know it all, when really the only information you take up on politics is viral videos and whatever cable news is kind of focused on. Let's see. I did also look at the Gallup poll they refer to, which was like the broad, we studied a broad swath of America on their political views, particularly in the two parties. And the thing to get there was that, of course, the Republican Party is fully conservative, but there's like a third of them are identified as moderate, the moderate Republicans. But again, the point of the article I just read was that if you ask the, you know, college-aged ones, moderate and conservative aren't really that different. Maybe by a few percentage points as like they care about fixing problems. Or the other concern is that moderate, these young moderate men, that if they're not engaged in other ways, then they're going to be engaged by the neo-fash, and that will be how they make the world a better place by, you know, going regressive and reactionary. Because they couldn't interact through the formal process of voting and parties and whatever. Because they don't have their own party, just like how a lot of Americans don't have their own party. Only basically the managing class or homeowners and business owners, they have parties that cater to them. Everything else is window dressing. So one more thing here. This is from Left Voice. I've covered them before. They're Trotskyist. But I'll skip the point where they say, like, this is where Trotsky organizing is the best organizing. It's unnecessary to the point. So the point that this article or this argument because we what I'm reading here are leftist arguments on the topics of our time. And I'm just reacting to them. You could take them as completely wrong, or I could take them as boneheaded. The point is to consider them, to actually consider as many arguments as possible to create a synthesis of sorts or a fully formed opinion. It isn't just kind of like, I heard something that sort of made sense, and I'm just going to repeat it. So this one is called titled, Could Hitler Have Been Stopped by Voting for the Lesser Evil? So this is, you know, kind of an argument against lesser evilism and looking at it from the historical viewpoint of, well, if all the lefties voted for the Social Democrat, which, you know, apparently Biden is supposed to represent, then, you know, we can stop the dictator or the fascist movement from ascending. Let's go into it. And this was published October 1st. Trump is continually emboldening white supremacists and terrorist gangs that attack protesters. How do we stop the rise of the right? The Democrats and their supporters tell us we need to vote for the lesser evil to stop fascism. But was that enough to stop Hitler? Now, it annoys me that so many socialists or so many lefties, progressives, whatever, like, even if they live in a safe state, I covered in the other episode on voting strategy, at least in safe states. But even in safe states, you have lefties who are like, I just want to get rid of Trump, or we need to get rid of Trump. And that's, and apparently their vote is helping with that. They need to, I don't push them on, like, can you say why your particular vote in New York matters to this effect? But it feels like they're not being part of, like, it's part of, like, the broad coalition, the popular front, the united front against fascism that is what voting lesser evil is about. Yeah, so that's the question and the thesis statement. Many people think Adolf Hitler came to power in Germany via elections. Bernie Sanders said something along those lines back in 2015, sparking much debate, and the conclusion seems obvious. If only more people had voted against Hitler, Noam Chomsky says, this is why we need to vote for Biden. The parallels between Trump and Hitler are often exaggerated by liberals. Trump is no Nazi, and the United States is not on the brink of fascism. Bold claim, right? Super important. Trump and his ilk are reactionary to the core. Yet, he is implementing all of the reactionary policies through the existing state. Like the system that we have it. Like he hasn't changed anything about the system as it is. He's just doing worse stuff with that system. He isn't relying on paramilitary formations. We can say that the Trump government represents a kind of weak Bonapartism. So let's take a sideline. What is Bonapartism? It's a Marxist term. It's a term from Marx. It's basically just referring to an authoritarian central state, but with a strong man, like, you know, charismatic leader based on anti-elitist rhetoric, army support, and conservatism. And that's Trump to a T. So Trump isn't a fascist. He's a Bonapartist. This obscure 19th century term to refer to the politics of mid-century France back 150 years ago. That's just how writers from left front roll. But hella useful, because otherwise we're stuck with the language of, like, is Trump a fascist or isn't he? There are other options besides fascist or just reactionary nationalist or whatever the hell. There's these other categories that we can apply that are kind of useful or clarifying. But we can still ask, would voting have stopped Hitler? The National Socialist German Workers' Party, or the Nazis, never won more than 37% of the vote in any national election. Hitler's road to power was a bit more complicated. It starts with Article 48. Early in 32, the German Reich held a presidential election. 84-year-old Paul von Hindenburg, yes, like the blimp, had already served 1 7-year term. The parties of the Reich called on World War I general to run for re-election. Hindenburg agreed and appealed to the spirit of 1914. For that old reactionary, this had been a time of national unity. For the working class, it had been a time where millions of young men were forced into the trenches. Strikes and protests of any kind were banned, and countless socialists like Rosa Luxemburg were thrown into jail. This is what Hindenburg stood for. You know, the lesser evil. Germany's constitution had been written while the revolution, this is the German uprising at the end of World War I, had been drowned in blood. The Social Democrats had allied with the military and the right to massacre thousands of workers, revolutionary ones, militant ones. As a result, the new constitution was only democratic on paper. So this is like that Weimar Republic that, you know, the Nazis destroyed. It really wasn't that Republican, as it had this Article 48, which allowed the president, a semi-quasi-monarchical president, to declare a state of emergency and take power. And the first president of the German Republic, a social democrat, Frederick Elbert, used these powers 136 times. He would dispose states' government deemed too left-wing and have the military repress workers' protests. Theoretically, Germany had a parliamentary system with a government elected in the Reichstag, but in 1930, Hindenburg installed a minority government that ruled by decree. In the previous presidential elections, 1925, Social Dems and the communists alike had opposed Hindenburg as a representative of the worst reaction. But in 1932, an even more right-wing figure entered the scene. Thus, the crisis. So to summarize, you had a Social Democratic Party with 1 million members and a Communist Party with 1 million members. In 1929, this marked a historic crisis, you know, the Great Depression. The middle classes were equally pummeled by this crisis, and many of them radicalized to the right and joined the Nazis. So it's important to point out that the Nazis' party, their power base, were middle-class people. When Hindenburg's term ran out, there was a serious fear that Hitler could win the most votes in the first round of the presidential election. The SPD, the Social Dems, could have mobilized their millions of supporters against both the conservative and the fascist right, but instead they decided to stick to purely electoral means, declaring that workers needed to do everything to make sure that a Reich president loyal to the Constitution sits. Their slogan was to beat Hitler, for which they meant voting for Hindenburg. They were convinced that this lesser evil would stop the rise of the Nazis. The Communist Party, in contrast, presented their own candidate, an Ernst Thälmann, and they declare that voting Hindenburg means voting Hitler. Like voting Green is like voting for Trump, which was sadly correct. So it's like all mixed around. In the end, Hindenburg won just over half the vote, with 37% going to Hitler, 10% to Thälmann. The SPD hailed this as a triumph of democracy. But what did the lesser evil president do? Well, Hindenburg's first move was to replace the chancellor. The right-wing Brüning made room for an even more right-wing Papen. Brüning had taken some limited steps to hold back Hitler's stormtroopers, but Papen gave them free rein. 2 months later, Hindenburg deposed of the Social Democratic government in Prussia. So this is like one of those watershed moments. The Social Dems had voted for the lesser evil, and this lesser evil threw them out of their stronghold. Hindenburg was making use of the same powers that the previous Social Democratic President Elbert had used to punch left. So what was the SPD to do, the Social Dems? They could have fought back against this coup in Prussia. The communists proposed organizing a general strike together. Now, this is probably kind of like this is how the commies remember it. Like, well, we wanted to organize a general strike, but they instead decided to capitulate without a fight. This was, after all, the constitutional way of doing things. For millions of workers who still put faith in social democracy, this defeat without a fight was demoralizing, far more demoralizing than a defeat in a pitched battle. And as far as American history is concerned, recent history, this is how we get all those millions of people who are non-voters. Because every time that there was a chance for the Democratic Party to fight for them, to fight with them, to call them to action, they said, no, we'll wait until next time. We'll wait until the midterms. We'll wait until the next presidential. And then we'll reverse all the bad stuff. But it never comes. Never comes. And even now, there's fellow lefties saying, now, or at least on leftist pages, and of course, you know, they're likely trolls, they say, no, don't vote Green now. Wait for the midterms. You know, when we don't have any ballot lines. What were you voting Green last midterm? What were you doing last midterm? What were you doing the last election? I bet they were saying, this is the most important election. We have to vote for Hillary. It never ends. It never changes. It's never the right time. So with this demoralization from the, you know, center left or the moderates, this allowed Hindenburg to take another step. You know, he wasn't stopped from basically banning the social Dems, their own government in Prussia, which has Berlin in it, by the way. The year 1932 closed with continued growth for the communists with intense strikes. Hindenburg fulfilled their wish. Oh, yeah, but it's Germany's capitalists pushed for Hitler to then be named chancellor. He did as he was told, installing a new coalition government made up of the Nazis and other right-wing parties. A few days later, Hindenburg, and maybe this is because of the Reichstag fire, it doesn't mention it, suspended freedom of speech and assembly, and by the end of the month, he suspended all democratic rights. Communist Party was banned, and not much later, then the Social Dems were banned, and then the trade unions were banned as well. When Hindenburg died in mid-1934, Hitler then became the Führer. So what did voting for Hindenburg accomplish? As Hal Draper put it in 1967, the people voted for the lesser evil and got both. To stop Hitler, the Social Dems and the communists, you know, the left, they needed to run a combined opposition candidate of their own instead of relying on moderates and Hindenburg. And unfortunately, this is how we're doing the same thing in America. We're relying on the moderate Republican Biden to stop Trump, or rather stop fascism, instead of running a combined progressive liberal leftist candidate. That's something that we could all like, okay, they're not a socialist, but that's who Bernie was, you know, the pseudo-socialist, the pseudo-liberal, the pseudo-progressive, or the solid progressive. That would have been the alternative, but that's not what occurred because, well, of all the complications of so lessons for today. Donald Trump is not a fascist, but Biden is also not Hindenburg, so, you know, disregard what I just said. But we can say that Trump's administration is encouraging the growth of the far right that includes openly fascist groups. The way to stop these fascists is not by placing hopes in lesser evils like Joe Biden, but instead to have workers' movement that places their hope. But basically have workers' movements and mass movements that actually fight for our rights and political power on our own terms. And I think we can do that in the Green Party or Green Left Party or orgs that are militant and independent. Okay, moving on.
Everybody knows everybody. Welcome to the second hour, where I will play an interview between myself and a Richard Moser. I don't know what was wrong with my mic, just giving a disclaimer. The audio on my side isn't good. In waveform, in editing, it looks exactly like Richard's. So weird, but otherwise, here you go. There are some recording problems, some connection issues. I tried interviewing him during the live show, and that didn't work because of the connection in the studio. Then I do it at home. Quite the puzzle. Trying to work on the right way of doing call-in interviews in the future. Hopefully, well, in time, we will have capability for calling into the show via phone. That would probably be best. And also thinking about setting up or at least referencing a Google Voice number for voicemails so you can leave messages for the show that I could then edit into the show like the Best of the Left once did, or if they still do it now. So I'm joined by a Richard Moser, longtime activist, retired from that now, but otherwise also writes the blog Be Freedom and writes pretty good essays. Together we'll be reacting to a Jackman piece called, well, basically about a United Front politics and the failure of it in the past. To summarize it, it outlines in the detailed, rich history of militant organizing in the 30s and early 40s, and how with the United Front or Popular Front politics during the World War II to defeat the Nazis, militancy was given up in return for being able to work with moderates, middle class, and business people, you know, to beat the Nazis in Germany and at home as well. This created a coalition that was able to defeat the Nazis, but then led to the destruction of the left after the war, particularly a militant left. And without that militancy, we've been stuck in a morass ever since. So that is where we will be starting off with the interview.
Okay. Now let's get going. My audio of the summary of the article. So why don't you just start with your observations on your just repeat your observation about the Popular Front metaphor, the historical example.
Right. Well, it's a excuse me. It's a useful analogy to today, particularly when we look at the attempts of I would say the main formations of the left to support the Biden campaign against Trump, you know, the whole idea being that Trump is a proto-fascist or something like that.
We have to stop him and all that. We have to stop the old fascist versus the new fascist.
So that's an appropriate analogy. And what the article does, it goes back and looks at what happened in the 30s when the left more or less created alliances with the American ruling class to oppose Hitler, to oppose Nazism in Europe. And it does a pretty good analysis of what happened. The differences are that the current left is much weaker and much smaller than the left in the 30s. Particularly, we don't have the same workplace organizing, workplace power that they did then. So we're actually starting off, in some regards anyway, at a lower level. There's some bright spots there. I'll come back to it a little bit later.
Yeah, so the left seems to always, what people identify themselves as leftists seem to expect that they have more power than they really do.
I think that's key.
Like in the primaries, like, yes, we're the majority. Bernie is totally going to win because we have more people, more small donations. We are more popular than the establishment as far as inside the Democratic Party because we have all these new people flooding in. But I think the moderates would say, no, your numbers are actually not that great.
Correct. That was a painful lesson from the primaries for a lot of people. People actually thought they were going to waltz into the Democratic Party, that Bernie was actually going to win the nomination, that they were going to allow him to do that, and that you could, you know, just take over power through the electoral process, which is obviously not the case.
I find it odd that Bernie actually seemed to know this, which is why the first time he ran it was purely to, you know, push Hillary. And the then the second time, it was more like he was being pulled to run seriously by the base, you know, progressive base, that then thought they were going to take over the party. But Bernie was like, then, since I'm running seriously, I'm actually going to be less strident, pull back on certain issues, and then hire all of these establishment people on my campaign.
Right. So this is analogous in the essay to, you know, the no strike pledge that the Social Democrats, or whatever you want to call it, the Democratic Party Socialists, you know, they begin to trim their sails and actually be less political, less militant, or less strident, and less radical. So they pull in with the idea that this is going to allow them to establish a working relationship with the powerful wing of the one of the powerful wings of the ruling class. Well, this hasn't worked so far, and it's unlikely to. One of the key takeaways from the essay is that in order to do this, where you start to compromise with the ruling class, is that you give up the independent base of your power, your independent power bases. And as soon as you step away from that and you lose the most militant sectors of the working class, that it diminishes your power. So there's a huge play here of accommodation to power. That's kind of what's been going on. And that's certainly what happened in the Popular Front, right? So the Communist Party at the time, they wanted to support the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union were the allies of the United States. And so it all made for a comfortable little alliance. But that alliance, of course, was extremely short-lived. During the period of alliance, there was an illusion that occurred. The Communist Party got to its largest membership levels. They appeared to have the most public influence, but it was the most public influence on, let's say, a watered-down program that was in accommodation to the American ruling class.
So that's the 40s and 50s, right?
Right. So that's roughly analogous to the Democratic Party Socialists, who are very taken with themselves that they've managed to elect some politicians, at least with their support. But, you know, what is it that you're electing? The hard thing about understanding about politics is that it's not a morality play. Issues are important, too, but basically it's a power struggle. So if you accommodate to power, if you give up the power struggle, you've surrendered before the struggle has begun. And that is kind of what happens during the Popular Front, in a sense. The other takeaway is this, that the left is truly, truly junior partners in this alliance. And when you look at who else the Biden campaign is allied with, you know, they've got 500 retired military leaders behind them. Most of the intelligence community is behind them. The Bush-era neocons have all merged and migrated into the Democratic Party. People like Negroponte, known for their bloodthirsty support of death squads, and Max Boot, an open imperialist, you know, who really encourages Americans to just embrace their imperialism. All right, so indeed, the you know, this is I guess true about the right wing of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, and other Democratic Party related socialists. Sometimes those organized around Jacobin itself. So I don't think there's enough of an appreciation for, one, how small and weak the left is. And I hate to say that, but, you know, such things become obviously when you're outside the two-party system. You are forced to recognize how small your force is. And the other thing
you feel stronger when you're, you know, at the table and working with the big wigs, you know, like the sense of aura that fellow activists have in Albany when they meet with, or their friends, or they have the number of the state senator, or they go to the same social functions and mixers as the assembly people, and so they feel like they have a lot of influence. But maybe they do individually, but then there's the structure of power. So I think like something that a lot of people need to get through their heads or understand is that there's a difference between like thinking that you're opposing power because of the person who's president versus like the power that exists that, say, Biden or the Dems already have. Like, the only thing, like, the people in power are the people who vote the president, meaning the Republicans. And thus, we're fighting the Republicans because the whole Democratic Party is out of power. Yeah, they're also in power as far as, yeah.
They're hardly out of power.
Yes.
And so if you even looked at Kamala Harris's debate, I mean, she was very clear about this wonderful coalition they've put together that includes all the generals, retired army leaders, the whole intelligence community, by and large, at least the leadership has lined up behind Biden. And
the Bush administration.
Excuse me?
The Bush administration.
And the Bush administration folks, all these neocons, have signed up with the have migrated to the Democrats. It was one big migration during the in 2016 during the Clinton campaign, and then another migration now of Republicans, the Lincoln Project, more right-wing Republicans in the Democratic Party, and the TIP, which is a you know ghosty organization. It's called the Transition Integrity Project, includes such people as Frum and Boot. You know, Frum was the ghostwriter for George Bush, wrote the Axis of Evil speech. And so you have these very powerful nodes of ruling class types who are right there in the Biden campaign. And now you have this wild coalition in which you have this elements of DSA, Noam Chomsky, people who follow him. They're all in this loose coalition.
Now even Greta Thunberg.
Right, right, yes. So they're all in coalition with the neocons. Well, isn't that interesting? And this is exactly the problem of the Popular Front. This was the problem. So what happens during the 30s is that after the Communist Party does their due diligence, really in restricting the militancy of the American working class through the No Pledge Strike and other things, is once they've served their usefulness in that regard, the ruling class totally crushes them. It's called the Cold War and anti-communism. And it roughly parallels what's happened in World War II, right? So we're allies with the Soviet Union during the war. And as soon as the war is over, and actually a little bit before the war is over, immediately the Cold War kicks in. And your erstwhile allies now become your enemies. So the communists who do their duty to the ruling class and keep the workers in check during a moment of incredible opportunity, that's to say World War II, are now taken out, you know, with the trash. They just roll over. The ruling class just rolls right over the communists and they become the evil
empire. Yeah. Something to note is that like the Allies never wanted to ally with the Soviet Union. It was something they were kind of pulled into after Barbarossa, the German invasion of the Soviet Union. Up until that very day, they were trying to play both sides, saying, "Yeah, let them kill each other."
Right.
It wasn't until maybe Stalingrad or a particular point in where it's just like, "Oh yeah, this is a big problem." He's killing everyone, and the genocide they were doing, maybe we should actually step in, because it's not just communists getting hurt here.
Right. Reluctant alliance. It's just a position of vulnerability that I don't think the pro-Biden left understands, that they are incredibly vulnerable to these very powerful right-wing forces that are also behind Biden.
Right. They probably wouldn't suggest they're pro-Biden as much as anti-Trump, plus the whole delusion that they're going to be able to fight for these particular issues independent of anything else, that you can fight for Medicaid for all without having your own independent platform to do so.
Yeah.
So maybe like to be militant in a strike as a bar would be to strike the Democratic Party, to not collaborate with that machine. That's
right.
Kind of my first ask when it comes to like doing independent politics. Then you can at least have this coalition of separate green left groups that are at least on the same page of we're not collaborating. We want to have our own power, even if that power is minuscule.
So, for example, the lost opportunity here instead of being, as you put it, anti-Trump or pro-Biden, what have you, instead of doing that in the electoral arena, there's been 1,000 strikes since the beginning of the pandemic. And to not engage those or support them, and there were people who did try, I certainly tried, and a lot of other folks, it didn't work out very well, but in large measure because the protests around police violence just completely swamped all attention, and since we're all glued to social media. But nonetheless, there's an opportunity for the left to build an independent base of power among the Black Lives Matter protesters, among the strikers, and instead choose to build power by reaching toward the right instead of reaching toward the left. And so this is another sort of parallel to the Popular Front problem that's discussed in the article. So it's a huge lost opportunity, I think, on the part of the left. And it does. And if we did build independent bases of power among the strikers, workers, and the protesters over police violence, then we would have a strong independent basis to resist this, what's coming, or what they're going to attempt to do, which is roll right over on us. And that's not, you don't have to just guess that. We already have the makings of the new Cold War and the new McCarthyism. Obviously, it was the Democrats themselves who were the chief architects of the new McCarthyism with Russiagate, and the chief architects of the Cold War, constantly goading Trump into more and more hostile posture toward Russia and China. And those processes are well underway. And unless the new Cold War and the new McCarthyism are going to diverge sharply from the old ones, which I strongly doubt, so the groundwork is already laid to attack the left. And of course, you hear this right out of Trump's mouth, right? Attacking Biden as a socialist.
It already happens. I mean, it already happened. The Dems and this Biden coalition punches the left every day. They do it, you know, they have their own army of bots. Now, I have a question for you, though. Building bases of power is, to me, almost an abstract idea, because when I'm on the ground interacting with our local Black Lives Matter groups, they fall into some categories, some already in the Democratic Party orbit, or they think of themselves, and part of like their idea of independence is also not to be organized by, say, the Green Party or some other formation. Like the fact that they're a little affinity group, they're an affinity group, that they're independent and they can fight for their reform or the abolition of prisons on their own terms, and by not collaborating with allies. It's kind of, it's dicey, because like in some circumstances, they don't want to be seen as being pro-Green Party because they do not want to anger or upset other progressive allies that they may or already have. It's this, they themselves are either in a double bind and they kind of know it, or it's just like they just see this as, this is a black movement and the local Green chapter are mostly white. So, you know, this, it's not like we're joining you, you are joining us. But then if we want to put our logo on a sign, then we're polluting BLM.
Right. Well, look, there's always all sorts of contradictions and complications. But, you know, what we haven't done and haven't really done well is learn how to do coalition building, in which, you know, you don't necessarily ask for, and certainly don't necessarily receive, someone's loyalty to a group like the Green Party or what have you. But in real coalition building, all the units of the coalition, the different segments of the coalition, they do maintain their independence. So there's still political forms out there that can be used. When I say build a base, I don't mean it in sort of the 30s sense of a political party, in that case, the Communist Party or the Green Party today or whatever, building chapters inside of BLM or something like that. I'm not really talking about that. Just more like coalition work. We're just simply recognizing that the degree to which the Black Lives Matter movement is an independent political force outside of the Democratic Party. I don't know the answer to that, and I'm sure there's tons of variation depending upon what city you live in. But it's still, it's one of the opportunities, you know, which you don't have many places to go. So if you're not going to go with the Democrats, where do you go? Well, you got to find some independent working class action. And that's what was delivered to us, so to speak, was the protests against police violence, which were, you know, huge, just huge. Now, of course, the Democrats got in there to try and co-opt the thing. Yes. Well, that's to be expected. And there's lots of contradictions to be faced there. Tons of them. So there's no easy way. That is for sure.
So can we pivot to one of your essays on the Civil War, the abolition movement, and the revolutionary reform? I have a history of the phrase non-reformist reform. I suppose revolutionary reform is easier to parse. Could you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, it's not unlike the Jacobin article. You know, it's another attempt to use history and find a usable past and to draw analogies to our time. So I went back, I looked carefully at what the Republican Party, this is the early Republican Party during its revolutionary phase, before the Civil War and during and immediately after the Civil War during the period of Reconstruction, and how they proceeded to build a national coalition or national movement against slavery. And one of the ways they did that was through what I call revolutionary reforms. Their primary revolutionary reform was what was called non-extension. Now, it's a tricky thing for people to get because you have to sort of have this dialectical viewpoint that it is a reform, but a reform that the ruling class cannot accede to. And that's what makes a revolutionary reform so important. So in this case, it was non-extension of slavery. Now, the moral abolitionists were calling for complete and immediate abolition. But they also had a very moralistic take. They viewed slavery as evil, like people today might view capitalism as evil. And instead of working on a moral basis, the anti-slavery forces worked on a political basis in which they tried to reach out to northern white labor and farmers to suggest to them that slavery was against their interest. So that's the core of the revolutionary reform is it speaks to people's interests, not just to their ideology or to their morality. So non-extension was the key. So what's the parallel to today? What reforms can we push for that seem really rational and normal and almost normal and not incremental, but that seem doable? But in fact, are more than that because they cannot be agreed to. Okay, they just cannot be agreed to. So, like for example, the Green New Deal, and I mean the real one that has militarism at its core. The ruling class simply cannot give up the empire. It can't. It's too intertwined with every other aspect of corporate rule. So, if you make a demand for a Green New Deal that includes the dismantling of the empire or the cutting back of war, just to cut back on the perpetual war. It sounds like a reform, but it's not a reform they can agree to. They just can't. Same with even defunding the police. There was a lot of good conversation about that defunding the police wasn't radical enough. But I tend to think that it is because they're not going to defund the police. They can't do it. This is their form of social control. They can't give it up.
They're already going back on a lot of the rhetoric. I think even Minneapolis is kind of going back on it. It comes to mind of like, even like cutting the military, which our Green New Deal does, even say limiting spending on the military, which every cycle it increases. What if it just capped spending? What if we, you know, in the same way of opposing capitalism in setting a limit on capitalism, a cap on pollution or a cap on growth. And this basically destroys the entire system as it works. It wouldn't be able to function. Just not to like say degrowth even, to say nothing of that, but just to stop growth or to have a steady state where growth is minimal.
Right.
There's a conversation on in left circles online of that maybe, so I just want to get your take that ranked choice voting, which we both and we in the future would be promoting and we promote now, have, the Green Party has, Does that count as a revolution or reform? Because you see, and you can point out that certain Democratic parties in the state or New York City are starting to put it in their own primaries, but right. not for the general elections like
right.
in May.
Right, right.
So I'm wondering if that's a weak push and form a coalition with progressives to fight for that particular type of election reform, but then it just kind of gets co-opted in a way, in the same way that public financing of elections, again in New York, is only for primaries.
Right.
And thus, for us and for independent party building, useless.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, devil's in the details there. So I think it's possible that certain kinds of electoral reforms could be a revolutionary reform, could be a reform that they cannot agree to, because they're not going to agree to give up their system, right? They've got the two-party system. It's worked well for them in a sense. So, yeah, if there's a series of reforms, I mean, the reform, for example, that they can't give up is Citizens United, right? They cannot yield. I mean, that's the biggest reform of all. We're just nowhere near taking it on at this point. But that's the key thing, is that the corporations are people and money is free speech. And that's been a century in the making, that to get to that, the sort of it's really that they took the 14th Amendment and twisted it inside out. I mean, that's kind of what they did. That's a whole other story. But
what I hate to see is the accommodation of the, you know, pseudo left or the center left to all of these losses, that we're going to stop fighting Citizens United like we made a fuss about it in Occupy. We're now just going to switch to a narrative of, we can fight dark money with mass small donations, like we all have an extra $30 laying around every goddamn day.
Right.
Which we really don't. In middle class, or people with savings or retirement fund or whatever, people who are kind of maybe on the edge of middle class or previously middle class seem to be able to give money from time to time. But at the same time, we're all kind of losing our buying power, for our daily needs. And, the incomes are still stagnant, even with the small gains in minimum wage in certain states, like right. New York.
Now, the level of wealth inequality, which is obviously increasing dramatically right now during the pandemic, shows that no, we can't compete on that level. You can run a presidential candidate based on that, and Sanders did that, and that's a huge achievement. I mean, it really was, but there's not enough room for two. It's a limited pool, a useful one. I'm really glad he did it, and it's very important for us to know that we can crowdsource candidates from our own resources, at least to some degree. But none of that is going to do anything compared to the immense wealth accumulated and concentrated at the top. It's the other thing that the left doesn't want to recognize, is just how much wealth there is and how enormous the inequalities are. And that's the other side of not recognizing how small we are. And this gets back to all these other arguments about the free market. You know, people like Naomi Klein, they were out there spinning this nonsense. What I heard from a number of lefties, that, you know, the free market was a description of reality. Well, it isn't. We're in a stage where there's a merger between the corporation and the state. And the reason those Democratic Party socialists don't want to recognize that is because if you agree that the state has merged with the corporation, then it is not possible to take power using strictly electoral means. And, you know, the
state to ban welfare programs, like actually passing single payer. Because in New York, it's, we can get every Dem to co-sponsor a single payer. But then, because the state is merged with corporate power, they will never actually pass it. So
right.
more, like, they can morally take a stand for it, as far as like the moral victory of getting every Dem in the state Senate to co-sponsor it, but then the leadership will never bring it to a vote because corporate state.
Right.
So this is where like the answer is more militant activism and organizing. And there's definitely an appetite online, and everybody who's even wringing their hands about voting for Biden in swing states and whatnot. They want to do militant organizing. So it seems like we just need to kind of focus. There's a paradox, and once you start doing that, then a bunch of other lefties or center lefties start crowing about the optics and how militarism, militantism makes us look bad. And we can't do that because then that will fuel the rights fight even more, as if us just doing our moderate approaches apparently assuages them somehow.
Right.
And so I just tend to ignore those concerns.
Right.
But there's too many of them in my area to kind of get enough people together to do something militant, because then they are kind of, they feel social pressure to just lobby or protest in the usual performative way.
Right. Right. Well, that's part of the, you know, this is the struggle we're in with the largest formations on the left are indeed taking this popular front approach. And people want the comfort of being in these larger formations. I mean, they do. I mean, you know, look at Chomsky. You know, people want to follow the big guru, despite the fact that we've been tragically and terribly wrong for the last 25 years when it comes to lesser two evil voting. Terribly wrong. But it comforts people to follow those kinds of leaders. So yes, indeed, it's a really tough thing. But the other side is this, Dan, which we saw with the Black Lives Matter movement and with the strike wave, for example, is that despite all of these problems on the left and this accommodation to power, that the contradictions of the corporate state and of capitalism are nonetheless being asserted. And we see that most directly, or in one way, through the last 50 years of austerity. It's finally getting to the point, to the breaking point. And certainly during the pandemic, I mean, we have millions of people who are unemployed and out of work, and the system can't even provide the basic kind of insurance for them, you know, can't provide any bailout. So the upside is that austerity has reached its kind of, appears to be reaching its kind of limits. And I think this is partly what's behind all the young people, including the young white people who are out there in these protests against police violence. Young folks know they don't have a future. And so they're much more willing to take some kind of action. So that's a bright spot. So the 1,000 strikes and these movements, movements against police violence, they are indicative of the fact that the contradictions are getting sharp enough that it's moving people, and basically moving people without, you know, it's from the grassroots up, you know, without left leadership or without much left leadership, you know. And I'm sorry about the absence of left leadership, but the rest of it is all very positive. So there are cracks in the system.
The resistance to left leadership, and that's kind of what I was describing, where you have BLM and they may be anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist even, but they don't, I mean, they're leaders for their cause. And there's a horizontalism at work where, you know, we had left leadership in the 60s, and the leaders always fail you or always disappoint you. So there's the tension between feeling like we need to be leaderless and then the reality that we need to be leaderful, and we need these kind of more right mass or a formal formation that does allow for democratic participation, actual decision making across inside a coalition. I'm optimistic that we're getting there a little bit in our area with left groups. We're starting to talk about forming a coalition group for collaboration. Not to merge, mind you, but at least to collaborate more and maybe have delegates and actually be able to actually do strike wave of our own or something like that. And do more than just our own little silo project, which has been Occupy Forward. And since Occupy didn't have a leadership that could guide anyone, and even if it did, nobody in that movement would trust it. As soon as there was a spokes council in Ducati Park, that was when we started hemorrhaging people on the ground. It's like now there's a spokes council where there's a leadership that meets separately from the assembly to make decisions. And I'm thinking to myself, well, these are they're representing the working groups, and the working groups are the ones doing the work. So why, I saw the problem with allowing the General Assembly to make decisions about the money that was being raised. In one way, full democratic participation is good, but then there was no barriers, boundaries, or organization of this assembly. So you had undercover cops, you had people who were on balance participating, and a lot of bad actors. So I was like, oh no, spokes council sounds like a great idea. But then a lot of people hated it. And I see the same kind of attitude has never, been unlearned, what I would call half victories or small victories. It's not that, like, the democratic socialists, they would see themselves as they have created more room through their popular front politics. That there's all this room now to elect all of these democratic socialist state senators, at least like five more in New York State, and then AOC and the Squad, even though they have all these positions that are quite. Those are my wrap ups. Why don't you give your own wrap up and thoughts on?
Well, I certainly, we never have really come to terms with Occupy and these big questions that you're proposing. I mean, the best strategy that the left has at this point organizationally is coalition work. And what I advocate for is the inside-outside strategy, which is just a way to find a way to work with people you don't fully agree with. It is accepting the fact that a high level of ideological agreement is neither possible or desirable. And this is very much in contradiction to most of the way the left has worked, but to find ways to work with people you don't fully agree with. I'm not saying you work with right wingers. I mean, that's the popular front, but that's not what I'm suggesting. Coalitions of people.
Well, to some, the popular front isn't working with Democratic Party progressives. It's working with these at very least libertarians or the like.
Right, or working with, ruling class elements from the military and intelligence communities. I mean, that's what it is in effect. Anyway, so the only answer I know is the coalition as a way to do this. And in the coalition, each unit maintains its own independence and isn't asked to give up its identity or its independent state. And so you proceed on not on an ideological basis, but on a practical basis of action. So what actions can you agree to? And why you agree to do them doesn't matter. Just that you agree to take actions. So it's practical oriented, practice oriented, organizing oriented. I mean, Dan, my general critique of the left of all, we don't have a strong enough culture of organizing. So I'll give you just a brief example. There's like two separate toolkits on the left. The most common one that we've used over the years has been the sort of polemical toolkit in which we have debates with other radicals or progressives or activists about any number of ideological issues. This is the familiar breakdown of various sectarian organizations, or I don't mean to be cast aspersions, but small left groups, which is mostly what we have, organized around ideological perspective. Yeah, and so we argue about all that, polemical arguments, and that's fine. But that's been, seems to me, where the left has spent most of its energy. There's another toolkit for organizing. And in organizing, we meet people halfway. We engage them where they are. We work with the world as we find it, not as we want it to be. And it's a whole different take than the polemical approach. And it's a take that makes coalition building much more possible. Okay, so it's the organizing approach is based upon engagement, not necessarily upon agreement. But if you don't have a point of engagement, you can't even get started. So you have to meet people part of the way. I'll give you an example. So let's take the left wants to argue about bourgeois constitutionalism or bourgeois electoralism. And, you know, we know that these things are sort of dead ends and we can talk about them and analyze them. But the problem is the millions have a mythic connection to these things, to the Constitution, to the political parties. So we can't just dispense with it. We have to engage it on some level, which is why I do Green Party work, at least as engaged in the electoral arena, despite what I actually think about the possibility. People are there.
That's exactly my reason.
Right. People are there. They're that's where they are. And you have to meet people where they are. So there's an overlapping toolkit. There's two different ways to approach these questions. And the fact is we have to deal with the consciousness that is out there. And, you know, you find these things out by doing organizing, by knocking on doors, by listening to people. That's so key. The left doesn't do it. By listening to people, you find out where they're at. By asking them open-ended questions, you find out where they're at. There's a lot of listening. This is not a shortcut approach. And the thing is, you meet them there, you start them there, but you don't leave them there, which is part, again, back to the problems of this anti-Trump coalition. Yes, you can become more popular if you just, you know, leave people where they are, you know, but you can't do that. So you're supposed to connect with them, engage them, but then try to move people. And it's not a fast process, and it's not largely ideological. You know, it's based on working together with people over political projects. So if I had to sum up, I guess that would be the one way to sort of see a way out of this terrible contradictions that we find ourselves. And I'm afraid to, sorry to say that I don't know what the shortcut is. And the whole thing is terribly, terribly complicated by the climate crisis, which most of the...
So thank you very much. I'm going to put, I just want, that's a really good framework from which to, if I may use the body metaphor, that's like the rhetorical bones. And then the task of, you know, my ongoing conversations is to try to fill that out with, you know, coalition building that's happening, try to see where it is and how it's working, and stories and examples. Of life, just it's one way to say meet people where they're at. What does that actually mean? Especially when, like, say, I talk with friends, people like he has a feeling that there's a chunk of people who just don't like him or don't trust him, and he doesn't know why. Figure that out. And same reason, like, you know, we're all kind of on an individual level, maybe all thinking that, like, I don't think I'm doing anything wrong. But then people are not able to or willing to engage with me. So it's one thing to say we need to engage with people or have a point of engagement. But then that's a question of what is a point of engagement. And that changes person to person or group to group. Because there are formations in my city, like in the black neighborhoods, where you have these cliques of older women who are church-going women. And I just do not have... I do not know what a point of engagement will look like with them. Because I'm, like, we're so, our subcultures are so, we only live 5 blocks away from each other, but there's a chasm of, like, what we're really into. Or right. What actions are we, like, willing to agree to? Like, you say the coalition's about agreeing to actions, but a lot of the arguments between all these tendencies is what type of actions to take. That's true. That's mine when that conversation. So
all that has to be worked out, right? Well,
yeah.
All those things have to be worked, and there's no shortcut.
True.
So, you know, the way I did it in my career and other times was, you know, you've got to talk to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And you got to talk to both people who are recognized as leaders and people who are not recognized as leaders. And, you know, you'll find out over time if you talk to enough people, the narrative will become clearer as to where people are at and what they're willing to do. I mean, that's the biggest questions in organizing. You know, what do you think we need to do and what are you willing to do to help us do that? You know, those are the big questions. So, you know, those open-ended questions, and that's where you do your research to figure out what is the point of connection and what is the point of contact. And it's, who said it's easy? It sure as hell is not. But compared to the option, the other alternative, which is to just tail along after the Democratic Party, you know, then the organizing thing seems like a much better. It's more labor intensive, but it's actually more direct. It's actually the short route. Well, there is no real short route.
Yes, exactly. It's, yeah. All right. So thank you very much. This has been Dan Platt with Richard Moser. So this has been Free Left Show. Keep waving the flags of the Free Left.